Thanks. Good morning, everybody. I'd like to call the August 21st Pension Committee meeting to order. It is now 10:05. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the May 22nd, 2014 minutes. Are there any questions or concerns? Hearing none, they'll stand approved. The first item on the agenda is the 2014 annual actuary report. So in your packet, you should see two binded reports that are, they say actuary report, GASB 43 and 45, and then there's another one that I have a piece of paper sitting in the front. So these reports here are done by our actuary, who is here, Michael Schooley, who will be speaking in a couple of minutes. They're done annually. I wanted to give you guys a copy so you can look to see how our pension fund is funded. I did a summary sheet for you, if you don't have the time to go through both of those reports, and that's what that Excel document is to show you. So these reports are done as of January. It helps us during the budget that we get it done before the budget process, so that's why the timing's a little different than our fiscal year. But you can see as of January, comparing 2014 and 2013, we have a $10.5 million increase. That was really good. Then we get into the funded percentage, and this is where Mr. Schooley is going to talk about the changes in the new GASB regulations. And you can see we were 83.8% funded, and using the same standards that we used in 2013, we would now be 93.8% funded, which is a 10% increase in our funded status. However, because of the new standard on how they can evaluate the pension, there used to be, I think, six ways to do it, and now there's one, something like that. So the new standard will now rank our pension at 87.7% funded versus the 93.8, which is good that we're still seeing an increase because we changed some of the actuarial assumptions and we've made some good contributions. But unfortunately, we're not seeing that full 10% that we would have liked to have seen. And then just going down, that talks about the pension. It talks about what we are required to contribute. 2013, it was 2.8. 2014, it's 2.7. So we're seeing a decrease in what we were required to contribute. Then the next section talks about the OPEB, or the health benefit side of our pension fund, and you can see we have seen an increase in there as well. The GASB regulations have not changed for the OPEB, so you can see we actually saw a large increase. We went from 70.6% funded to 78.2% funded. That is an 8% increase. There's also a decrease in our annual required contribution. And then I put some other statistics, what the average compensation is of our employees, the average age, average service. All this goes into the actuary report. Then down below, I thought it would be good information for you to have to see what the annual required contribution has been over the last few years, and then what the county has actually contributed. So you can see we've been consistently going over and beyond our annual required contribution, and we plan on doing that with this 2015 budget. So that's a real brief summary of those two large reports. Now I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Schooley to talk about the new regulations.
Okay. There's a two-page handout that I gave you. One is on front and back, and this discusses the GASB changes. Right now, the GASB 67 and 68 statement has been released, and that affects the pension plan for fiscal year 15 for the GASB 68 numbers and fiscal year 14 for the GASB 67 numbers. The difference in GASB 67 and 68, GASB 67 is plan reporting, GASB 68 is your financials. There's also an exposure draft out right now for the OPEB, and it's a similar change, and that'll take effect for your financials for fiscal year 18. So that's coming down the road. The main change of GASB 68 from GASB 27 is what you have to report as a liability on your financial statement. The prior to GASB 68, what you would do is you'd keep a running total of the contributions you made to the plan versus what the expenses to the plan. And you've always, the expense has always been equal to what the required contribution is. You've always made that contribution or exceeded it. So you've had, and you can see on the first sample page, you had a liability, it was actually an asset of $18 million, almost $19 million, $18,807. The new rules are going to make you show a liability. It's a $9,574,000 liability. And what that is our actuarial determined liability versus what your assets are. And you're not 100% funded, so you do have a liability. However, you are better funded than most of the public sector plans I worked on. Most public sector plans, they're happy if they hit around the 80% mark. A lot of them over the last few years have been a little low with the bad market. This last year or two, they've caught up a little bit. So that's the key thing, is that liability you're going to see move from an asset to a liability. The other main thing that they're doing is they split up funding versus expensing. So the funding policy that we have set up in place, we're going to continue to keep doing our calculations the same way we've been doing them. It's a good method to fund the plan. You're well above the normal. But that calculation is done on different assumptions, different cost methods. So you're going to see in our report, you're going to see two different liabilities that we're going to show. So that can be kind of confusing when someone's trying to read the report. And you can see on the bottom half of that first sheet that the overall present value of future benefits is the same under each method. It's $91 million. That's if you take everybody that works there today, you put enough money aside today to cover all their future benefits you're going to offer them. If you had $91,920,000, that'd be enough to cover everybody, assuming all our assumptions are met. The two different methods for the one on the left is for funding. That's the $72,658,000, and the one on the right is the accounting. That's the $77,721,000. It's just a different spreading of the costs over the working lifetime. So you can see one has a lower liability but a higher normal cost. And the normal cost is the annual liability that we say will accrue during that year. The expense that you're going to end up showing, before what we did is we just took that normal cost, that annual calculation, and the unfunded liability, the difference between that accrued liability and the assets, and we spread that over a period of time. And we said that was your expense. Now they have a whole different approach. They take they still take that normal cost, but then they take what they call an interest charge on the liability and an interest charge on the assets, and an amortization of any gain loss that came in during the year to come up with the expense. So the expense is going to fluctuate up and down a lot more now, because now you have, when you have liability gains and losses and asset gains and losses, you're going to see it jump up and down. there's a couple key things that you need to disclose under the new GASB statement. One being that you have to have, they want you to have a funding policy. So we use a 7.5% discount rate. That's what we assume on average you'll earn on the assets. You're probably okay without the funding policy, but if you have the funding policy in place, we can prove that 7.5% discount rate is good to show that all future contributions will meet future liabilities. And there's another issue that that you probably need to make a decision on, and that's a measurement date. We can measure these calculations up to a year and a day before the fiscal year end. Right now, we collect your data as of 1-1, and so it's 6 months prior to the fiscal year end, and that's probably a good measurement date for you to keep, for you to put in place. We could move it up 6 months earlier to get the numbers sooner. To do that, we would have to collect information at a different point in time. So that's just something to think about. Our recommendation would be that you would go with the January 1st measurement date, unless we're struggling to get you the information in time.
As the funding policy, do you have examples that you could share with us that other municipalities have done that we could implement?
Yes, and I may have put one in the pension report
okay.
this time. But yes, I can send
okay.
you an email
you.
For that. And there's examples in GASB itself that okay. we can piggyback off of. Similar to the pension liability that you're seeing on the OPEB, there's a page in the OPEB report. It's on page 6. When we did the forecasts, they had in the exposure draft that it would take effect for fiscal year end 17. That has since changed. They moved it back to fiscal year 18. But you can see where, again, you have we're projecting around fiscal year 16 that you're going to have a $4,494,000 asset that you're showing on your balance sheet. And then if you look down at 2018, it's going to end up being a liability of $13,889,000. The main reason that people look at these is all about bond ratings. Your plan is so well funded that I can't imagine that it would impact any bond ratings for you guys. So even though it's you know bothersome that you had an asset and now you have a liability, the plan is still it's funded better than it was last year, and it's just a different way to look at it. The purpose of them to do this was to have everybody showing the information on their financial statement the same so that everybody was using the same methods and assumptions.
So none of this impacts the annual required contribution?
Right, the funding is separate now, right? So the funding is going to stay the way we've been calculating it all along. So yes, it does not impact that contribution.
We're still assuming the 8% return?
7.5.
7.5.
We lowered that in the study over the past year.
Okay.
A lot of public sector entities have been coming down from the 8 to the 7.5% over the last two or three years.
Okay. I just saw on page 6 it mentioned expected returns at 8% on the OPEB.
On page 6?
Yeah, on the... Oh, no, this is on the regular pension, sorry.
Pension. Yeah, because we switched it between... The January 1st, 2014 is 7.5, so you have to roll your calculation on that assumption, what it was at 1/1/13. Mm-hmm. Which was 8% back at that valuation.
Yeah, if you go back in the report where it talks about current year and that, it talks about the 7.5%.
These changes are very similar to what private sector has done back in around, I think it was around 95.
This is contribution amounts, are they, is it 13.5% for pension and... Have you recommended?
Yeah, the pension is 13.5%. I have one right off the top of my head.
How much is the OPEB contribution? Is that percentage wise? Is that in here?
Probably is. In there, I can't remember where it is.
We used 25% total for the budget, is what we ended up using. But as you can see, that's over the what the required contribution was. So it's about 23% when you combine the two.
Okay. It's about 10% for OPEB.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Oh, that was a typo. That was not another example that I was doing for another client. So.
Awesome. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure there wasn't some other number related to this. Okay.
I'm sorry about that.
So that should really be 7.5, 6.5, and 8.5.
Correct.
Okay. The numbers are right below, but it's just important.
I have one question. So continuing to use the funding method, we will be okay to meet our obligation to become fully funded. I'm concerned that if we are using the expense method and it's taking our percentage down, that method would get us closer to becoming fully funded. So if we were to change that, our annual required contribution would be higher, but that would be moving in the right direction.
Right, so we could switch the funding method from projected unit credit to entry age.
Okay.
And that may increase your contributions now, but it would lower them down the road.
Okay.
The two funding methods will eventually come together at the same point as your group ages. So it's one's not going to necessarily fund you there faster than the other one.
Okay.
In your situation today, the entry age normal cost is lower. So if you look on that first page, the expense and the contribution, that's assuming no gain losses in that line, are almost the same.
Right.
So if you switch to entry age, you'd probably increase your contribution by about $10,000.
Okay.
Right. So it's not going to get you funded there much faster. Down the road, it could even be slower.
Okay.
Depending on the age of your group.
I'm also looking at reporting two different kinds of methods might be confusing for anybody looking at our financial statements that aren't as well versed into this.
Right. So that we have seen clients, because of that confusion, want to switch to entry age from the projected unit credit.
Okay.
So that is a thought. If you want to have the same methods to make things less confusing.
Okay. Would it be possible when you start working on the next report for our reporting, if I could have both numbers to see
yes.
if it okay,
yeah.
would make much of a difference?
Right.
Okay. Thank you. Does anybody else have any more questions? Mr. Schooley?
One thing I would share for your comment is we've seen a lot of counties in Pennsylvania who have used the aggregate method for funding, and because of it, fairly antiquated way of doing things, but because of the accounting industry changes, decide to do change to entry age for funding as well as for accounting purposes. So to sort of
make it easier.
Your thoughts, that's what I'm seeing out there.
Okay, great.
If you were using an aggregate method, that could be a significant.
It wasn't significant. Some of them were doing it because it helped lower their contributions a lot, but it accomplished two goals. It got the two systems aligned and helped to lower their arms also. They quite frankly, a lot of them aren't as in good shape. They're in pretty good shape, but not as truly what he was saying. You guys are in really good shape, in my opinion, from what I see elsewhere.
Thank you.
Yes, most people don't fund their OPEB plan, so that alone is a huge, huge thing that you guys are doing. That
most aren't funding even the normal required contribution amount? Or?
No, mm-hmm. Most of them just pay the pay-as-you-go costs.
Wow.
GASB, the OPEB stuff only came in 2008, so most people weren't even aware that liability was even there.
If they can't cover their pension, they're certainly not going to do their OPEB. I mean, you know, that's secondary to them, I'm sure. I mean, they would like to, but the reality of it.
Yeah, private sector hardly ever covers OPEB. It's a lot easier in private sector to remove an OPEB benefit than it is in public sector. That's kind of where that strategy started.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Thanks.
In terms of public disclosure, in connection with financial statements, when do these numbers become more readily viewable to the public?
Okay, so the GASB 67 is required on your 6/30/14 financial statement, and that's where you see that unfunded percent.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you're going to see them right there. The 68 side of it is your expense and your what you actually book on the balance sheet statement. So the 67 is going to be there as a footnote. It's always, the unfunded liability has always been there as a footnote, but now you're going to see it, instead of seeing it on projected unit credit, you're going to see it on the entry age, which is that lower funding percent. So you're first going to see this on this statement as far as that footnote, and then you're going to see it impact the balance sheet on fiscal year 15. And then similar for the OPEB, you're first going to see the liability switch from projected unit credit to entry age on your 6/30/17 financial statement, and then you're going to see it impact the balance sheet on 6/30/18.
So just to follow up with that, what we would have reported under the old GASB is the 94% funded, and now this year we're going to have to do the 87.7. That's just the difference for this year.
Had there been community reaction or questions related to previous disclosures? I mean,
no, because as of right now, we have an asset. And I don't think it's going to be a big issue because we're going to show the liability, but we do have assets on the side in other forms to fund that. So I don't see that there should be too much of a concern.
I think it's great the county is continuing funding at the level and above whatever, you know, the required contributions are.
Good. Well, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay. The next item on the agenda is the investment analysis for the quarter ended June 30th, 2014. And Mr. Schoen is here.
Morning.
Discuss that.
And is it fair to say, because I know a lot, there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, you're not 100% funded on your pension fund, but your pension fund, in calculating that liability, it does take into consideration future salary increases, does it not?
Yes.
So when you think about wanting to be 100% funded, it's really not thinking about just what has been earned to date. It takes into consideration future expected salary increases. You know, one sense, would you really fund all of that right now, or do you fund those as their salary increases occur? You know, my opinion is if I saw, you know, a $200,000 house and you had, you know, say, a $30,000 mortgage on it, that would be 85% funded. And if you're making your mortgage payments every month, you're probably doing a good job with that. So, and I concur with Mike when what I see elsewhere, as you know, we have, I guess, in total about 14 county clients throughout the Mid-Atlantic area. And you're one of the best funded on the pension side. And on the OPEB side, hands down, you're far and away better funded than any that I see. Not all of our clients have the OPEB liability, but most of them do. Most of them still have no funding. Probably about five or six of them do have funding. The next highest funded ratio I see out there is probably about 33% to 40%, and you're at, what, 75 or so? So, I mean, you really are just far, far and away above everybody else in funding. And as the article in the News Journal mentioned the other, yesterday, those assets aren't there to pay for the benefits. Somewhere down the road, there's either going to have to be huge contributions that future generations are going to have to pay for what was earned now, or employers are going to try to find a way to either lower or eliminate that benefit promise. So
we're also factoring in 1.4% COLA for the OPEB too. I mean, if we didn't have that set up, isn't that correct? That we're also putting in a 1.4 on average annual. So I mean, that would, without that, we would have a higher percentage of funding, wouldn't we? I mean, that would be common sense. So I mean, we're being real world too. I mean, you know, so I think it's good.
Yeah, I'll even tell you, almost all of our county clients do not grant a COLA anymore. They used to, but most of them don't. And it's actually elective each year. They can decide to do it or not. So most of them don't have it. And when I have seen them do them, they've been more like, in the 2% range. So
when you try to do that, I mean, you can play games and get that percentage up there if you want to for optics, but you're not really doing the right thing by your pension or OPEB. I mean, I think we're doing the right thing. So
yeah, under the new rules, you can't do that game anymore. With,
oh.
You just give the ad hoc COLA and not value it.
Oh, I see. Is that okay? Thank you.
Still do it for funding.
Oh, I see. Yes, that sounds good. Thanks.
So inside the top report, the one with the swirl on it, not the one with the globe on it, okay, is the performance report. You'll see some stapled together pages. I'll get to those in a moment. Those are some of the things we talked about at the previous meetings. If you go under tab number one, and we'll give some information, just what occurred in the market the last quarter. See on page one, upper right-hand corner, the real GDP, that's inflation-adjusted growth, generally has been moving along at an annualized rate of about 3% over the last several years. The first quarter of this year, it was negative, but most, if not all, economists attribute that really to the winter, to the weather. Because you do see it bounce back up second quarter. The gold line is really, I think, a better trend line. It's a year-over-year growth rate. Think of that as growth, sustainable growth, but not robust growth. And that's really sort of what we've really been seeing the last several years. Initial jobless claims have been coming down. Unemployment rate has been coming down. A lot of people would like to see it come down at a faster rate. In a lot of sense, I would too if I, quite frankly, if I was one of the unemployed, I'd surely want it to come down at a faster rate. On the other hand, if, in my opinion, if you have things move at too fast a rate, you start getting this boom and bust approach to things. So I think it's probably moving along at the pace that it probably can. Under page two, upper right-hand corner, you see the inflation expectations. And the blue is actually what the market is saying inflation expectations are, and it's the difference between the real yield on tips and the nominal yield on treasuries, and the difference between the two, the spread of those two, is what expectations of inflation are. What that means is the market is saying that this, and these are 5-year break-even inflations, but we also do 10-year break-even inflation. Expectations of inflation are to be in the low twos, 2-2.25%, which is below at least long-term historic norms. Historic norms have been you know, most actuaries, I think, use 3. I presume you might use 3 also as your underlying inflation assumption.
2.5,
sorry. 2.5, okay. Well, about, so a lot that I see out there are 3. I shouldn't have set myself up that way. I should. A good lawyer knows what they're going to say before you ask the question. Okay, there you go. Thank you. Thank you for the save there. And I'd say, actually, even when you look at some 30 and 50-year trends, depending on which time, it's very subject to beginning date and end date, you know, you see, you know, even higher amounts than that. But the gold is actually the consumer, the individual's inflation expectations. So that's just what they sort of expect to be, which is around just 3%. On Fed funds rate, the blue is actually what it is. That's the rate that the Fed lends to the banks with the hopes that the banks will then relend. As you all know, and you can see from here, the Fed funds rate has been basically zero since the beginning of the Great Recession and continues there. The expectations is that sometime either later this year or next year that will start going upward, but still significantly below long-term historic lending rates. On page 3, asset class returns. Quite frankly, we're better than we, or I think just about anybody else, would have expected so far this year. And I'm saying that through the end of June, because then July the market was back down. But then August, it's bounced right back up. U.S. equities over time do about 10 to 10.25%. Expectations were that over a 5 to 10-year period that you should expect more about 8, 8.25. Two reasons for that. If you have lower inflation over time, you really want to see, and this gets to the reporting you're going to have to do on your SRI for your financials, you're really going to have to show what the real rate of return assumptions are for an asset class and then add your inflation assumption to get to your nominal return assumptions. If inflation assumptions are lower, then you can expect both fixed income and equity returns to be lower. Also, after a really strong run over the last 5 years, typically it's usually more of a reversion to the mean. Having said all that, for the year to date, the U.S. equities are up 6.9%. That's for half a year. If you basically double that, that means about 14% return just about for the year, and that would be higher than historic norms. So the market, at least for the first half of the year, did better than we, and I think anybody expected. International markets continue to lag the U.S. a little bit. That's international developed markets. And then the emerging equities, which have been the ones that have done significantly poorer than the developed markets, actually was the big winner this quarter. You have some exposure in both of your plans to emerging markets. You do not have in my opinion, you don't have an overexposure there. But both through the state pool that they manage for you and your OPEB fund, you have exposure to that area. And bonds have done better than expected also. You know, we've talked about in the past that if you have the yield on a 5-year CD or a 5-year bond is 2.5%, you hold it for 5 years, what kind of return are you going to get? 2.5%. Bonds for the first half of the year did 3.9%. It's because you not only had the yield, but you also had interest rates go down. With interest rates going down, you had capital appreciation, and some of the two gave a positive return. However, that means yields are even lower than they were before. So if you look for the next 5 years, starting at a lower base than you were at the beginning of this year, then I would say expectations of fixed income are going to be even lower than we had talked about at the beginning of the year. You already captured some of that gain. And high yield bonds, remember, I like to joke about, but junk bonds, that's what they are, just renamed. As the economy gets better, they tend to do better than core bonds. They tend to also have a high correlation to equities. That's why you do not have higher, I should say, correlation to equities than traditional fixed income and treasuries. So that's why you do not have an exposure to them at all in your OPEB fund. You do have some exposure and through the state pool, but not a huge exposure there. Okay. And then inflation-sensitive investments, TIPS, commodities, and U.S. REITs, which were the ones that were pummeled last year, are the ones that have actually done the best this year so far. On page 4, what I take from this is it did not make a lot of difference whether you were in growth or value. some, but not much. Sometimes we can see wide disparity in returns. Your portfolio is designed to have a little tilt toward value, but not much. So I won't say you're style neutral, but you're fairly style neutral with a little tilt to value on the OPEB side. On the pension side, you actually are style neutral. Okay. And the big winner year to date has been mid-cap value. I will tell you, over 30 years, 25, 20, 10, 5. If there was one area you had to pick between large, mid, and small, value, core, and growth, the best performer has been the mid-cap value space. That doesn't mean you put all your money there, but our position is, if that's been the best performer, short, intermediate, and long term, why not have a little greater emphasis in that area? And the OPEB side, with the changes you made at the beginning of this year, you actually have a specific Vanguard mid-cap value fund to give you that extra exposure into that area. Not a big extra exposure, but a little bit extra exposure. So small cap, which has been the darling coming out of the recession, is actually although positive, has been the one that's been the lagger for the last 2 years. We think, got a little bit over-frothed. Everybody has seen these. Would anything you want me to point out on page 5 or 6, or should I move on to the body itself? Okay. So hit on the highlights on there. Page, go to the next tab under pension. So the market value as of the end of June was $70.9 million. Quarterly return in dollar amount was $2.69 million. That's net of your investment management fees. Year-to-date gain of $4.38 million. Continued very strong performance, and your quarterly return was 3.8, and year-to-date was 6.3. Okay, very, very strong returns. Okay. Looking ahead, cash management. I'll stop in a moment and talk about that. And then potential fidelity replacement, which is what was brought up and asked us to speak about today. And when we get to the staple part, that's information on potential fidelity replacement. Let me go to cash management. Gene and I got together several weeks ago to talk about this. What has been, and if I misstate something, please correct me, but I think I'll be pretty close on this. The process for quite a few years has been that the county made their contribution, their ARC contribution, in basically December. Okay. That was a fairly large cash infusion relative to the size of the plan, especially the OPEB fund. Okay. Cash infusion for the OPEB is about $2 million, $2.3 million.
The OPEB is OPEB. 1.8.
1.8, okay. So I said I'd be close myself. And with the fund being about $30 million now and had been about $20 million, that was 6 to 8% of the portfolio. So all of a sudden you have this come in. Now, what do you do with that? Well, at late June, you take the money back out because during the course of the year, the benefit payments were being paid by the county, not out of the fund itself. Okay. So what do you do? All of a sudden you have either way too much fixed income in your portfolio relative to your 60-40 split, and the fixed income actually has to go not into intermediate bonds, which is your benchmark. It has to go into either CDs, which you did for several years, or this past year you put the money with Wilmington Trust, but they bought very, very short-term treasuries, okay, to do that, and then yanked it back out 6 months later, okay, and you were over-allocated to fixed income. Or, as we did with the OPEB fund this year when that came in, we rebalanced the portfolio to get back to 60-40. However, when the money came out in June and you had to take those treasuries out, now you were way over-allocated in equities. So all of a sudden I went to Gina and said, we've got to sell, I forget what it was, a million or so of equities to get you back to that 60-40 split. Now, for July, that happened to work well for you in having sold some equities. But a lot of times, that's not the way you, in my opinion, the way you want to handle things, of putting it. So we've talked about it. I will share with what I think the process will be, but if you'll, going forward,
sure.
Is that instead of putting it all in at one time and yanking it all out at one time, is that on a monthly basis, the contribution will go in that's closely equal to what the expected outflow will be. So it'll go into the fund. The payment will be made out of the fund instead of out of the county, okay? And that way you've matched up your cash flows much better. You don't have this huge gyrations, you know, both from an investment perspective and then a reporting. And then also one of the things we've struggled with is on the investment policy statement. What was drafted many years ago was 60-40 and 40% fixed income and no allocation for cash, okay? Typically, we would see in a plan at least some allocation for cash, but typically it's 1 or 2%. Well, you go up to 8 and down to 0, and so where are you? And really, how do you evaluate performance of either of these plans if you've got this either, you know, huge benefit of having cash when the market's going down, a huge detriment of excess cash when the market's going up? So,
So what's happening is our contribution equals our expenses for the year. So it's a wash, basically. So what I'm doing is using our contribution to pay for the expenses so that our investments can stay in the investments and we can keep a balanced portfolio and just use the contribution. Now, if council contributes an extra $1 million like they have in the past, then that's when we'll have to decide where it goes. But this way, we have an even cash flow going through the whole year.
Yeah.
So the budget then, if I understand you correctly, the budget for 2015 for the pension contribution is $3.3 million, give or take.
Yeah, on that spreadsheet.
On the spreadsheet.
Yes.
So what you'd do is you'd take 1/12 of that monthly or something other?
No, it's pretty close to 1/12. It's whatever the expenses will be is what I will pull in for the contribution. And then at the end of the year, we will probably have a little bit more contribution than what our expenses were. Then we'll decide at that point, the committee, where we should put that money. But it'll be about 1/12.
Okay.
And if there is extra, then that really is long-term investments.
Yes.
You know, because it's above and beyond. It's the short-term stuff that, as I say, wrecks havoc of, and then, you know, how do you get yourself back in target? How do you get back quickly enough? And so this, I think is, so...
So what that does, though, it moves a bunch of transactions from the county's books to the pension plan's books. Am I right? Does that have any other consequences?
No, because I really am doing a pension entry every month anyway, because it's like it's owed from the general fund to the pension, so I'm recording it monthly. This way it's just the cash is coming right from the general fund that would have taken it anyway, but it's recording the expense right away.
Okay. Good.
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay, and then I mentioned Fidelity replacement, which I'll get to in a moment. On page 13, you can see the position of the portfolio, additions, investment returns, And on page 14, you can see the amount allocated to each of the managers. And 15 is just the allocation among the different asset classes. Okay. And you can see the gold, I call it peaking and troughing, so coming in at the end of the year, big amount of money going in and going out. Now, page 16 for returns, for the quarter, you can see your return was 3.8%. Year-to-date, 6.4, which significantly outperformed the policy index at 4.8, actually ranking in the top 10 nationally of all the public funds that are, let's say, subscribed to this universe. There's about 30 firms like ourselves throughout the whole U.S. that pool all of our data, and then there's one firm that we pay to compile all the database. Say you rank in the top 10 nationally, it's about 230 plans out there. I think what's even, I was going to say more better, how's that for great English, is that yours is a relatively conservatively run fund. It's not as conservative as the OPEB, but with your targets of 60% equities, the average plan out there, which had been about 60% equities, is now more in around the 65% range that we see out there, okay? Moment I'll talk about. So why has performance been so good? The one-year return at 17.2, 2 years 14.5, 3 years 10.3. That's an annualized return, and you can see your rankings, you know, above average and close to the top quartile in all those time periods. And again, with a conservatively run fund. As you know, 60% of your portfolio is run by the state. The state runs it in a, you know, I'd say similar to how we would see a big plan run. But then you also have intentionally then said you want to be a little bit less risky than the plan. I shouldn't use the term risky, but just dial down a little bit from your side because, you know, and that's why you added these other investment pools from the fixed income that's managed by Wilmington Trust, DuPont managing the equities, and then Fidelity. So being more plain vanilla, even with a low equity allocation that you have, has been beneficial for the last 5 years. Actually staying over, I can't say you've stayed away from hedge funds in this because you haven't totally with the state plan, but you've been less than the average of a large plan would be, okay? And some very strong performance by most of your managers also. Okay. You go to page 17, you go to the graph of all these that I would point out is the one on the upper right-hand side and the one on the lower left-hand side. The upper right-hand side is what's known as up-down capture ratio. And that's, I'll tell you how that's done and then what it means. You know, it's, you look at the returns in up markets and then you see your return relative to an up market, okay? And the higher you are on the page, the better you've done in the up market. So when the markets have been up, and the market really is your blended policy index in this case. If you take that blue square and look sort of, I'll say over to the left, I'm going to say that's roughly 95. So in up markets, you've done 95% of your policy index. Okay, so if your policy index was up 10, you would have been up 9.5 on average. But if you go straight down from there, you'd see the down capture ratio is, like I said, it's a little bit more than 70. It's probably about, eyeballing that's maybe 72. So in a down market, you were only down 72%. Your policy index. So if the policy index was down 10, you were only down 7.2. So you've protected extremely well in the down markets and captured most, but not all, of the up market capture ratio. The combination of those two have worked well for you, especially in a period when the markets have been, you know, very strong. The lower left-hand side, so that tells you magnitudes. The lower left-hand side tells you how often, what they call the batting average. And you see the blue square, it's right on the 100. That means every time there's been a down quarter over the last 3 years, and there's only been two, so you've outperformed your benchmark. And if you go sort of look at that, eyeball it all the way to the left, not quite 50% of the time, but close to 50% of the time in the up market, you've outperformed. So you've, again, you've captured a reasonable amount in the up markets and really protected well in the down markets, which I think has always been your philosophy anyway, you know, is to be more protective in the down markets. Now, there's always that bit of that trade-off that you need to meet that 7.5% return assumption, or you should target that, you know, and is a 60% equity allocation sufficient to meet a 7.5% return assumption, you know. Now, keep in mind, 7.5% return assumption is a long-term return assumption. It's not just the next 5 to 10 years. Correct me if I say anything you disagree with. I'm fine with that. But so I do see some of our clients saying, "Oh, Michael, you've been telling us the returns aren't going to be as good the next 5 to 10 years. Should we drop it down to 6.5?" I said, "Well, keep in mind, you really have to look at 40 years. You know, so is that a reasonable return? 60% equities to get 7.5 over a longer time period." I'm not so sure that 60% is sufficient to get to the 7.5, even over a long term. So something to think about. Okay. Then lastly, for each of the individual managers on this plan, is you can see DuPont has had very good returns for you. Their job is to, they're not going to shoot the lights out. Their job is to add incrementally. It's more than enhanced indexing, but it's not full, I'll call full alpha play. And, you know, for the quarter, up 5.8, year-to-date, 8.8. You can see the numbers, you know, very strong performance relative to the benchmark and to their peer groups. If you recall, about the first 6 months you had them, they struggled in early 2010. But after a couple, two not as good quarters, they've come around very nicely. I'm going to drop down to the state for a moment and work my way back up. The state had a very good quarter. Well, they had a good quarter, and they had a very good year, up 7.3%. Some of that seems to be attributable that their private equity investments got marked to market in January or February. So some of the, I'll say, pent-up gain that may have not been reflected in the other years came to market in January and February. That is the nature when you have things that aren't marked to market at times. Sometimes there's pent-up gains, sometimes there's pent-up losses. So there's some smoothing that goes on around that, but at least the pent-up part showed in a positive way. So that's why you saw sort of, was an extraordinary gain in first quarter. I think some of it was actually attributable to some of what really might have already been there.
Is that only once a year they do the mark-to-market?
I'm not sure of that. I think it's more often than that, but I'm not sure. But consistently, you know, the combination of, you know, this, as I say, if I brought you the structure that they have and said, here's how we want to manage the OPEB fund, I think you'd say, Michael, you lost your marbles. We're not going to go into private equity. We're not going to go into the hedge funds. We're not comfortable with those areas. But it's different when you're in a big pool like that, to a point, that and you have some of your money there, that you can access some of these things that a plan your size would not normally have. But then also taking into account your own personalities and your own comfort level, that alone might have been too aggressive for you, and then you've modulated that some with what you've done with Wilmington Trust and DuPont and Fidelity on the portfolio. Okay, so I'd say by any measure, you should be very happy with your returns, pension side. Now, I'd like to go to the other bound report for a moment, so while we're on the pension, because you asked us to provide some education and discussion materials about Fidelity, and is it a candidate to be replaced? And I'll tell you, I've always observed that performance actually of the fund has been decent, actually pretty good, but it's also a retail fund. Now, that can still be okay, but if you look at it in more granularity, you know, and they've always, you know, in a mutual fund, typically when they pick a benchmark, they pick a benchmark and they stick with that, even if that benchmark isn't the right benchmark in a few, you know, years later. They've always said their benchmark was the Russell 2000 index, small cap. And when they use the term low priced doesn't mean they're a value manager. Because sometimes when you hear low price, you think, okay, value orientation, low price to book, low price earnings. Low price means just the price of the stock is low. It's got to be between, I think it's $5 and $20 a share. Well, you can have big companies in there. You can have little companies in there. You can have growth companies in there. You can have value companies there. And when you break it out, this is on page one on the left-hand side, okay, the blue is you see them actually with some giant stocks. Those are the mega stocks, the large, the mid, the small, the micro. Can't really even call them an all-cap manager, because an all-cap manager would have, you know, a skewing toward the large-cap side. They're not a mid-cap, they're not a small-cap. If you look at the Stiles holding on the right-hand side, and we break them apart between what's value, what's core, and what's growth, what's large and mid and small, you know, there is a tilt toward the value side, for sure. But again, it's primarily more mid-cap than anything else, if you had to pigeonhole them somewhere. Mid-cap core, mid-cap value. One of the other things we do, you can see that Picasso painting in the left-hand side, is we do a style analysis. So, you know, what do they look like? You know, by looking at their returns, and you do a regression, you come up with, okay. And what we look at this and say, sort of all over the map. They look very much small cap value back in June 99 and for quite a few years. Now looks, and this is not by on their holdings, it's their return patterns. Now they look a lot more, and it's sometimes hard to differentiate some of those colors, but they look probably most like mid-cap growth. Well, it's very tough to, if you had something that sometimes looks small-cap value and other times look like mid-cap growth, you know, what all are you getting there? And how's it fit in your overall portfolio? The other thing to notice, if you go to page 3, and look at their holdings, they're actually really about 50% U.S., 50% non-U.S. But they're not U.S. stocks only. And it has $48 billion. Well, small cap managers not going to have, or surely should not have $48 billion in their fund. You know. So what are your options? Okay. One is no change. It's okay. We see that. We've liked the returns. It's okay. We'll stay with that. One is we went and talked to DuPont and said, look, we've liked what you've done on a large cap side. Can you just expand your mandate and just do an all cap that will cover the mid and small cap, so you've covered the whole capitalization spectrum? And we got a yes and no. So they said yes, and they were very accommodative as best they could. They said, we can do a small cap for you, but we can't combine it with the other one because we have a different manager who manages the large cap and a different one that manages the small cap, and there are different styles. We really can't roll the two together. So they say they could do that. And they couldn't do small and mid-cap. They could just do small cap, okay? They offered a very competitive fee at 0.5%. So 0.5% on a small cap portfolio is a very competitive fee. Normally, they would charge 85 basis points. But they realized the trading cost on something of that size with small cap funds would eat up a lot of the return. So they were trying as best they possibly could to be accommodative. Or another approach is just to buy an index fund. Complete what DuPont has with just a mid or SMID Vanguard index fund. Okay. Now, on page 5, you see that we broke all those DuPont, Vanguard, Fidelity. You see information on each of those. Firm inception, the firm assets, their style, strategy inception, assets in that particular process, their fees. You'll see that Vanguard, because it's an index fund, is extremely inexpensive. Mutual fund on two of those, separate account on the others, and then what the preferred benchmark is. S&P completion means it's everything beyond the S&P 500, so that index fund would take the piece that's not covered now by DuPont. We then looked at returns, and we always put these last because we don't want you to be, you know, when people see these first, they don't look at the other numbers. And you can see year by year, and then you can see on the next page cumulatively. Now, why don't I speak cumulatively, and then I'll go back year by year. Cumulatively, the best performer has been the Vanguard one. We'd expect that over DuPont to some degree because it's got the mid-cap in there. If you remember earlier, I mentioned mid-cap. If you had to pick just one area, mid-cap would be the area to have. So the DuPont product doesn't have that exposure in there. Fidelity does, but they have large cap and small cap in there also. The return differential isn't great between the two. It's 30 basis points over that time period and 20 over 5 years. Last year, huge outperformance, Vanguard over Fidelity. Then if you go...
Were you able to quote DuPont net of a fee at 50 basis points, or did you look at their 85 basis points?
These are net of fees on all of them, so it's net of fees on all of these.
Okay.
So. In the mutual funds, they already come net of fees, and then for the separate account management, we backed out 50 basis points of fees. And then page 8, we tried to put in some of what we thought were maybe some pros and cons of each approach.
Do we know, like, the breakdown of the fund overall? I know it's hard with a state pool in terms of small cap, mid cap, and international, or maybe that's here somewhere.
Yes. I don't think we get the capitalization information from them, but let me go back to... Okay. Yeah, from the state, all we get is on page 31, mm-hmm. and it doesn't give the breakout between large, mid, small. Good. And actually, the state is pretty active in how they manage things. They'll do a decent amount of tactical allocation just between stocks and bonds, just at the asset class level. So although we could look at a point in time of where they are, you know, it could change, you know.
Do we, of the 46% that we have allocated to U.S. equities, do we have any specific breakout of what the mandate is, large, mid, small, value growth?
No.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'd say, and that's, our belief is not to do that because we look at the asset class level, but we also do observe for you and for other clients that, you know, I'll say from our view, there's a little bit of over-allocation to mid-cap. That's probably a good thing. A little over allocation to value, that's a good thing over time. But that's not at the investment policy level.
When the Fidelity was originally put in, it was meant to be a small cap, correct?
It way predates me, so I couldn't answer that.
I'm trying to remember. Remember, Jeff, it was probably, I think it was small, mid. We were, like, when we first started, we've had it.
It really did well for a long time.
It has. It's done. It had very good performance. Well, that's why it's still there. It's probably one of the.
It still does well. It's just expensive for what it does. That was my biggest concern.
We kept considering maybe trying for something else, but you kept looking at performance, mm-hmm. and it really held up well, you know. So, kind of kept.
Was there any consideration to just using the Russell 2000 ETF, since that's what it seems like we were originally intending that to be?
Easily could use a 2000, whether it's an ETF or an index fund. But because DuPont goes just down to 500 and is missing part of the mid cap, we want to really, now this completes all of it, it's going to have small and mid cap in it together. So mid cap below the 500.
Did I understand you to say that DuPont currently does not have a small cap offering, that they would create one for us?
Well, they have a small cap offering, but they don't have, it is strictly the 2000, okay? It's not, if you're looking to, I'll say, have the full capitalization on the non-state piece of it, they're, their large cap one is the S&P 500. It's not the Russell. If they had the Russell 1000, then you could go to the Russell 2000. Right now, you'd be actually shy on the mid-cap area. So if you concur with our opinion of they should be at least neutral capitalization, if not a bit overweight to mid-cap, you're actually going to be underweight if you just go a small cap, large cap approach.
Yeah, the point of my question was getting to... If we move to DuPont, would we be adopting an unproven, from their standpoint, an unproven style of management?
No, they have that, and the numbers you see there are specifically their fund, their product. Yeah.
Okay.
So our money would be combined with that fund.
They'll actually manage a separate portfolio for you, but it's. They have others that they manage. They don't have a whole lot they manage in that approach, but it would be a separately managed portfolio. It would not be part of a commingled fund. I'm pretty sure I'm correct when I said at one point they had a commingled fund and it just didn't get funded enough, so I think they're either closer or in the process of closing it.
Is it an all or nothing decision here that we have to move the whole thing, or is there a way to maybe take advantage of the lower cost with Vanguard, but maybe keep something with Fidelity?
Or half and half.
Or just DuPont? I mean, if we decide DuPont, I'm assuming they want all the money because they give us a better deal on the fee, or are they willing to take less as well?
I would say, and I don't want to speak for them, so we could ask them, but my guess is this in and of itself is a pretty small portfolio for them. So
right.
to cut that in half on a separately managed portfolio, my guess is that as much as they want to be accommodative, that they would probably say,
yeah, it's $5.2 million, right?
Yeah. For them to run a $2.5 million small cap portfolio is just, you know.
And the Vanguard pricing break is at $5 million for that pricing, 10 basis points?
Yes. Now, they do have...
it's only a couple more. It's only a few more basis points if you go to the other one.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yes.
Maybe 15 or something?
Yeah, 15,
it's still
18, something
really
like that. It's not a lot, yeah.
Inexpensive. If they only got, like, say, $2 or $3 million.
Okay.
Right.
So we're locked into one fund, which, you know, sorry. Forget the.
Actually, if you don't mind, I'll call my office and I'll ask them to. So we do know the number. So make sure we have.
I like the pond because there is the potential, hopefully, of outperforming the index, I mean, but I know we're looking at history too, but they've got some really top-notch analysts there. We had a presentation a few years ago. I mean, they're as far as medical field, they had a doctor.
Brian,
he was in charge of, remember that? I mean, these people were very impressive, and you saw their resumes.
Okay.
I mean, tremendous.
Can you give me Pat then?
But, you know, the charts tell you a story too, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, if everyone's investing in pretty much the same thing, to see fees that can vary by 40 or 50 or 60 or 70 basis points.
Can you look up real quick
really,
and then text me back?
I mean, you have to be a genius almost all the time.
The one that we're showing to,
that
to
much better
Sussex,
in this, with the same
if
pool
they don't go to 5 million, mm-hmm. Therefore they go to a different
index funds
class,
have proven to be, you
what
know,
the expense
very difficult to beat, you know, it's
yeah.
Over the long term.
Yeah.
And this is, as he said, this is a 40-year
deal. Well, it's at 10
deal.
Basis points if they're at 5 million.
I kind of like actively managed funds just because of the excitement factor, you know, yeah. And you feel like you're really participating, you know, you can beat the market, but I mean,
yeah.
We have to go with the best for the fun, you know.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. Thank you. Okay. Okay. So actually, the 10 basis points is if you're less than 5 million.
Okay.
If you go over 5 million, it's 8 basis points.
Okay.
8 basis.
It's hard to argue with that.
Do we want to leave the low price stock fund? I mean, is this time to do it, or it's been strong in the past? But I mean, as Mike has pointed out,
it would have to be something that I think personally that we would have to stay on top of, just because its style drifts so frequently from small to mid. But if we stay on top of it as a mid value fund, it's performed pretty well. I mean, it is just a little pricey. There's a few other options out there that might be a little less expensive in that space and maybe stay a little truer to style. I just sort of did a quick search. There's like 20 or 25 funds in that category that maybe are as expensive or less expensive and have better or equal performance to that one that maybe are truer style. But it's not awful. It still screens out pretty good, mm-hmm. on a long-term basis. But the fact that it drifts a lot is troubling.
Right.
It's just, that as a committee, we'd have to stay on top of it. But as you pointed out, it's been a very top-performing category right now. Mid-value is a good space to be, as long as we know that it could change in the future. It might not be mid-value next year.
Does management have anything to do with this? So the fund, has it been any turnover there or anything, or just?
No, it's really because they really don't, their approach is they're buying low price. It's really geared to the retail market. So they want to sell something that's, look, you can buy stocks at low prices, okay? Yeah. And that doesn't always put you into value, doesn't always put you in growth, doesn't always put you in large cap or mid cap. It takes you wherever it takes you.
Yeah.
You know?
It just depends. Like when I pulled a Morningstar, there's some of their top holdings are things like Seagate, Microsoft, Best Buy, United Technology. I mean, those aren't necessarily mid value stocks.
Right.
So it's a little bit of an overlap.
Do they hold on to the stock after it exceeds $20? I mean, I think if you got a winner there, you just let it ride, or?
The turnover's low on Morningstar, right. Really low. So they're not selling them out very frequently, doesn't look like, at least based on Morningstar.
Right. As long as the fundamentals are there, I mean, I kind of think they should stick with them, but, you know, it makes sense. What do you think, Dave?
I don't have strong feelings one way or the other on it, really.
You're not sentimental.
It is kind of it is kind of a different animal in that it crosses over between mid and small and large cap. But then it kind of, when we look at our whole fund, it does that too. We're not really real focused on it. I think it really was supposed to be mid cap, or we considered it more like mid cap when we got into it.
I don't have strong feelings about it either, mainly due to the performance history, but I guess the investment policy conformance is maybe the bigger issue. We've adopted an investment policy. If this holding can't be relied upon to conform, then maybe that is the bigger issue. From a performance standpoint, it's hard to, they're all pretty much over the long term, they're pretty much the same. I mean, DuPont has had a rough year that colors these, that chart on page 7.
Yeah, and the reason why is because they are small cap, and small cap has been the underperformer this year, whereas the other one's mid cap, the other one's, you know, sort of all kinds of caps. So this year, we would expect them to struggle relative to those two.
Okay.
It's kind of an advantage of the Vanguard, and it's more of mid and small cap exposure. But
yeah, personally, if we were to do anything, it would be for the policy reason, more than the performance reason. And if that were a big enough reason, you know, I, all other things being equal, I'd be leaning toward Vanguard because of the lower expense ratio figure. And they're going to be smart some of the time, and DuPont's going to be smart some of the time, but in the long term, you got 40 basis points that somebody's got to be smarter than the other or dumber than the other because of the expense ratio being so much lower.
Is that Vanguard? Is it DuPont? Is that an all long portfolio, or what? How are they managing that? Are they
all long?
All long. Okay.
All long meaning that they're not, you know, just buying, you know, the stock. They're not going short on it or anything. No hedging, no leverage.
But 8 basis points is all fees and expenses, or is it?
It's the, you know, total expense ratio of the fund.
That's everything. So.
We could try like the half. I mean, I think you suggested half with the Vanguard and half with Fidelity, and just monitor it and see how things go.
For us, that 5 million is a lot of money for us.
I mean, that's going to save 70 basis points on a couple million dollars.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a lot.
Yeah. 15 to $20,000. Yeah.
Does somebody want to make a motion to move $2.1 million from Fidelity to Vanguard?
How much did you say?
I was saying 2.1, so it was a half.
A How much is it now?
Or 2 point, or I guess no, it would be 2.8.
2.6.
Six, sorry.
I'd move that we move 2.6 million from the Fidelity to the Vanguard Extended Market Index.
I would second that.
Okay, I have a motion and a second to move $2.6 million from Fidelity to Vanguard Extended Market Index. We'll take a vote. Mr. James?
Yes.
Mr. Baker?
Yes.
Mr. Leahy?
Yes.
Ms. Ryan?
Yes.
And I vote yes. Motion passed. Thank you.
Should we say the remainder on the next motion? Either remainder of the funds?
The remainder of the funds are going to stay.
We discussed DuPont. You know, I don't know. I know we have it in Fidelity now, but do we want to just stick with Fidelity and not go with DuPont? I mean, they would have a higher, we'd have a higher, they wouldn't like it. I mean, we'd have a higher rate, right? I mean, the management fee, I should say.
Yeah, my guess is if on the rest of it, I said I don't want to speak for DuPont, but I don't think they would particularly want to manage a $2.6 million small cap. This in itself would have been a small portfolio for them anyway.
They've got our other money, but I know what you mean. This is independent.
Sure. Well, that's why I asked them, would they roll it all together?
Yeah.
We could have a nice all-cap product there, mm-hmm. but it just didn't work for them. So.
And I think it would be appropriate to continue to look at the Fidelity and possibly look at other options down the road. And
yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
I'm fine.
We're not locked in. That's the.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm fine with Fidelity. I mean.
I think we watch them for a while, and but we can always come back and say, let's look at like a SMID value type manager or something like that. You know?
I think Fidelity has a straight mid value fund that's a very top performer as well. So maybe we could just look straight at that.
Yeah. DFA's got a good one, too, mm-hmm. to look at. Target.
Kind of like the DuPont since we went with it. It just seemed like it's grown and grown, you know, just really it's been solid.
So while I then go on to the fixed income education, then I'll go to the OPEB because the fixed income education applies to the pension as well as the OPEB. Okay, so under fixed, we were asked to put together some education on just overall fixed income, how it works. Should you consider expanding your guidelines that you have there? As you may recall, at least some of you recall that when we first wrote the investment policy statement, which I think was back in 2007 for the pension, we had written it, I'd say, like we would more traditionally do, which would be benchmarked to the Intermediate Government Credit Index. And and actually, even within that, that was conservative compared to most of the rest of the world. And then so this kind of asked us to actually make it more conservative than that and put some limits, and we'll get into that as to what the limits were even relative to that benchmark. So just on page 9, types of bonds, and I apologize for not getting this out to you sooner, but we just finished it up the other day, so and we were working on the performance reports and the search work. So what I want to do is give this to you. I'll hit a couple highlights, and then if you'd like to the next meeting, we can go into more specificity. But give some idea of the types of bonds from treasuries working our way all the way down to high yield and bank loans, agencies, mortgage backs, et cetera. Some definitions, maturity, and a lot of times people like to use the term maturity, but duration is a better measure of the interest rate sensitivity of a portfolio. Maturity is just if you have a bond and it's a bond that's due at 2020, it's got a 6-year maturity. Duration takes into consideration the weighted average cash flows from that bond. Because when you have a bond, unless it's a zero coupon bond, you don't get all your cash flows at the end. You get your interest payments over time. And as you receive interest payments, then you can reinvest that at the then current interest rates. So a higher coupon bond will tend to have a lower duration than a lower coupon because you're going to get more interest back relative to the principal. And as I say, that's a much better measure of interest rate sensitivity of a portfolio. Okay, I mean, if interest rates go up, I've always talked about interest rates go up, bond values go down. Interest rates go down, bond values go up. but how much? Okay, and so the longer the duration, the greater the duration of the bond, the more impact it is by the change of it. Okay. The quality, that's the credit quality, you know, working from AAA all the way down into the non-investment grade bonds. Okay, the lower the invest, the lower the quality, the higher the yield somebody's going to demand, because if it's a lower quality, you know, you have greater risk of not getting paid back your principal. Well, if you're going to take that risk of not, greater risk of not paying back your principal, you want a higher interest rate to induce you to take that risk. Okay. And therefore, the lower the quality, generally the more closely it resembles what happens in the economy. That's why we always talk about, you know, high yield bonds, junk bonds, performing more like equities than traditional fixed income, because as the economy gets better, the risk of default lessens. If the risk of default lessens, then the interest rate, the premium, the spread that you need over your treasury gets less. So treasuries, if they're yielding 2, you might say, wow, in 2008, 2009, I'm really scared that I'm not going to get paid back. If you want me to buy your junk bond, I'm going to price it that I want 15% expected return on this. Okay, just to pick a number. Now, in today's world, you know, the spreads are about, it's 250 to 450 basis points, depending on that, somewhere in that range. I forget exactly, but in essence, it narrowed considerably. So if somebody said, boy, I need a 15% return to get to buy your low-quality bond, now I need, say, 6 or 7%, well, now interest rates have come down. The value of that bond has gone up dramatically. Okay, so the discount off of par will have contracted. Okay, yield to maturity. What is the yield you get to maturity? And spread, as I was mentioning before, is the difference in the interest rate of two bonds of similar maturity but a different quality. And again, as you move away from treasuries to, then you go, say, to double A and then single A and all that, the spread needs to widen. Okay. On page 11, bond quality ratings. Working from investment grade to non-investment grade, one area that people sometimes they think of triple B, and they say, non-investment grade. No, triple B actually is investment grade. What you see here are the ratings. These are S&P ratings. Moody's would be like, you know, BAA would be how Moody's would do it. It's very similar to S&P, but it's a little bit different. And then the double C's, C's, and D's are very low-quality bonds, okay? Now, I've really sort of worked you through this, so I won't go into, other than on page 12, there's a little bit more explanation as to the rationale as to why when interest rates go up, why do bond prices go down, okay? Characteristics of U.S. bonds, put in here, credit risk, it's typical benchmark that you might see out there, and the benchmark duration. Okay, so treasuries, you know, when you see a treasury index, there's a lot of long treasuries. So when an index comes out, it's taking all the holdings, or I'll say the vast majority of the holdings, and weighting those, and then you have this benchmark. So when you look at the performance of Wilmington Trust, you know, one of the things we have to do is go through and say, okay, so what is the right benchmark for Wilmington Trust? Because even though, you know, we had written like in the pension plan that the pension plan's overall benchmark is the Intermediate Government Credit Index, the state is managing to the aggregate index. Wilmington Trust, you've asked, although you've widened what you've allowed them to do to some degree over the last several years, before they were only allowed to, they had to buy at least 75% treasuries. Okay. And then it was changed, interesting, it was flipped, it can be no more than 25% corporates. That's not the same as has to be 75% more of treasuries, because you can have agencies and asset backs, you know, I mean, you can have mortgages and asset backs in there. But point being, from Wilmington Trust perspective, if they can't buy, if the benchmark has, say, it has asset backs in there, and it has mortgages, and it has corporates, and they're not allowed to get up to that level. Then they shouldn't be punished in evaluating their performance if they're not allowed to buy if the benchmark has 50%, you know, non-treasuries, and they're only allowed to go up to 25%. So what's the right benchmark for them? That's why we use the government benchmark for them, okay? So on and so forth. You can see the durations. Then what we said is, and actually it was not, I think, not a good exercise for yourself, but also a good exercise for ourselves, was to go back over the history of each of these plans and what has been the benchmarks. So in November 2009, your FI's fixed income, the fixed income policy benchmark for the overall plan, was the Intermediate Government Credit Index. That point is actually known as the Lehman's Intermediate Government Credit Index, but when Lehman was gone in 2009, in the Barclays. The suitable investments at the overall plan level is spelled out. Security selection, you know, no more than 5% anywhere. And you don't see a benchmark for Wilmington Trust, because at the time, Wilmington Trust was not managing it as a, really as a portfolio. There was, you had an individual at the local branch who was buying primarily treasuries for you. So it wasn't an actively managed. You were buying and holding. And just so you know, buying and holding can be an okay process. You just have to know, you know, what the trade-offs are that you sometimes will, might give up return. If you say, look, I want all treasuries, that's the most conservative way to deal with things. And in 2008, that was a great way to deal with it, because treasuries was the best place to be. But you give up some return for that. And that's the match, sort of the match creator say, you don't, you can't always stay on first base, but you don't recklessly run to second base. That's my analogy there. The average quality, you know, and then a duration band. In 2010, it was moved over that Wilmington Trust was then going to actively manage the portfolio, and the management of the portfolio went to Wilmington, and Dom DeRamo is, I'm going to use the term, actively managing it, but in a passive way. And we said, what does that mean? They're buying, for the most part, they're buying and holding to maturity. However, they are monitoring. It's not just parked aside and not looked at. They are watching it. They will make some duration changes if they feel appropriate. I mean, if they think interest rates are going to go up or down. And if they see a security that they become concerned about quality-wise, they will go to change it. But it's pretty much, they will only sell something. So it's, I'll call it enhanced indexing, for lack of a better term there. Maximum exposure was 25% to the corporate and 75% minimum to treasuries. That's why their benchmark was Intermediate Government Index, which sort of allows them to buy agencies also, but in the benchmark. In 2013, there was a council resolution that changed Wilmington Trust benchmark to Intermediate Government Credit. We're not sure how it landed there, but that's what the resolution was. But it allowed it to be, it had to be no less than 50% in government securities. And I say council resolution, it might have been the investment committee resolution, so I might have misspoken there. I don't recall, I have to look it up. So that was a little bit of widening the latitude of how they manage money. And the duration bands were changed to plus 25% and minus 50%. If you recall at the time, I said our concern was interest rates were more likely to go up than down. Want to give the manager latitude to shorten up more, but not go longer more than 25%. And that's why you have, typically you'll see an even split there, but that's why you went to a not even split there. And then the IPS addendum was put in place on April 2013 that spelled those out. 2014, that a new IPS was put in place. It wasn't just the addendum like you had last year. And that spells out the fixed income policy. It says intermediate govy, but that's for the piece that's not managed by the state. So what we had done before in 2007, we sort of rolled it all up into one and said, and more if we thought about saying, it's near impossible to do that. We'll have the state pool, we'll designate that as the state pool, and here's their benchmark, and then we're gonna have the non-state pool, and we'll have the benchmarks for that. And that's why you see that there. So that's some history on the pension side. Okay. On OPEB, you can see that December 2010, pretty much, if not exactly, mirrored what you had on the pension side on the OPEB. And all your fixed income on the OPEB side is managed by Wilmington Trust in a method very similar, if not identical, to what you do on the pension side. Investment manager contract, you know, made sure it was clear, was the intermediate govy benchmark. There's the resolution, 2013. Still not quite sure how the govy credit got there. The IPS addendum that widened the band, same changes you saw on the pension side. And then there's a manager, we went to clean up, there was some question as to, from Dom, as to, you know, which benchmark do they have and all that. So there was some cleanup work done earlier this year that, you know, mirrors what you see on the pension side. So that, as I say, I thought that was both hopefully for yourselves and for ourselves to have that sort of history of what went on with it was very important. So the roles of fixed income. What are the main roles of fixed income? One is diversification. They do not always move in the same direction as equities. Keep in mind, sometimes they do. So it's not like if one's up, the other's always down. But the correlation between equities and fixed income over the last 20 years has been somewhat negative. So it's more likely that they move in opposite directions. That wasn't true the 20 years before that. There actually was a positive correlation between the two. I think that we're loosening up with the fixed income markets is probably why you're starting to see this negative correlation. Other benefits, the income and the liquidity. Page 17, really warming up here. You know, one of the things is to look at, and we stressed before, is a bond is not a bond is not a bond. You know, it's you've got treasuries, you've got agencies, you've got corporates, you've got asset backs, you've got high yields, you've got bank loans, you've got EM debt, you've got all kinds of things. And what we want to show you here on this page is when the equity market has been down, okay, we took four time periods, what have those other areas done? So in one sense, you look at treasuries and you say, wow, the yields on treasuries are lousy. You know, they're less than the other areas. You know, do we reach for more return? Do we reach for some spread product? On the other hand, when the market's been down, what has been the best performer? Not only treasuries, but long treasuries. Okay, because generally, if the economy is going down, interest rates will usually go down less, either by because there's less borrowing and or the Fed is taking positive action to drive down interest rates. So interest rates go down, bond values go up, and the longer the duration, the longer the maturity of the bond, the more positive that impact is. However, last year, as interest rates went up, long treasuries are the ones that were hit the worst. But that was also at a time when equities did very well. You know, so if your goal is to best offset what equities are doing, you want to go with treasuries and longer treasuries. If what you're trying to do is to get some more return, is you move away from an all treasury approach and you go into some spread product. And the question is, how much? What types and how much? Do you loosen up your band some?
I thought it was interesting that you mentioned earlier in the meeting that the 60-40 split may not be enough over the long run to achieve that 7.5% rate of return, and perhaps a spread product may assist in that, rather than upping our equity exposure, to put some spread product in there to help boost that return. That was my thought.
And I concur. Yeah, I mean, I concur in that is another way, or maybe even might even be some pieces. You know, you might say, I'm not comfortable going with 65, but maybe 62. You know, or maybe you increase the international a little bit, or maybe and you do a little bit more spread product. It might be a combination of things. But as you are now, I would say, even compared to our other clients who have 60% equities, you're definitely more conservative, especially on the OPEB side. You really look more like a 58% equity kind of portfolio than even a 60. And then it's even more difficult to get to your return assumptions.
The Wilmington Trust portfolio, is there a holdings list on that? Have they actually done any
Yes.
It's in that.
Yeah.
So forth.
Yeah. Should see if it's not. Let me see if it's in here. Yeah, I guess we don't put it in here, but we actually generated a really big report. So believe it or not, it's much bigger than this. and so yes, there we can get that for you if you'd like it. So,
I was just curious as of the Wilmington Trust portfolio, how much of it is still strictly in government and how much is U.S. Treasury?
So if you go to page 27.
Page 27.
27 and 73.
Excuse me, 27 in the book with the swirls.
Okay. Back to that.
Yeah.
So is there a reason why, or did we didn't limit them on the corporate percentage other than the 50%?
Well, you limited corporate to 50, I mean to 25.
Right.
And then you actually sort of did the reverse. You said that government bonds have to be 50% or more. So it wasn't specifically just corporate. They could go into other types, investment grade, but they could go into mortgages and asset backs also if they want to.
So we still have the 25% corporate limit? Is that how you would interpret it?
I don't think so. No, I don't think there's a straight 25%.
It's just 50 could be government. 50
right.
Can be corporate or agency right. backed. Or.
And as of the end of June, you're still 72.7% in U.S. Treasury and agency. That's in the upper right-hand
right.
corner.
And the on page 73 on the OPEB, we're like 80% or 81% treasuries and agency.
Yeah. Well, I think, and some of that might be due. Well, no, those treasuries were sold before the end of June, weren't they?
Yeah.
They were okay. Because for a while there, you were even higher because you had those treasuries for the cash that you were, the short term, yeah.
I don't, you know, as long as with the high quality requirements that we have, I think we could at least go to some more corporate to add a little more yield.
Yeah, one of the questions I can have with them, and I have not because I want to have this education process. So you're allowed to go all the way down to 50% in U.S. treasuries and agencies, but you're at 72.7. Why is that? And this is before you expand their mandate. Why aren't they're not bumping up to them to that? You know, why expand that if they're not going there? Yeah. You know, so I can surely ask them that.
A little better yield for, good quality.
So is that totally within their discretion, or are we directing them to be?
That's in their discretion. So they have the latitude to go up to, say, down to 50% in, U.S. Treasury, in government securities. So. It's at their discretion there at 72.7.
You said they're buying and holding individual bonds. Is that correct?
Pardon me?
They're not investing in funds as well. They're just all individual
bonds. Individual bonds. And it is very, they charge 20 basis points. So, it's very competitive. And they are doing, they say, for the most part, and this part was, may not have been contractual, but it was very much understood that basically buy and hold unless you needed to sell something.
Yeah. So I'm imagining that the reason that they haven't moved as quickly is because they didn't want to sell those individual bonds. They just were holding them to maturity and then using the cash, reinvesting the cash. That'd be
very possible, yeah.
Okay. Makes sense.
Makes sense for a pension, long-term outlook and everything.
Mm-hmm.
It realized the full value of the bond and at the maturity.
Yeah.
And we were leery about investing in the bond funds because
just the interest rate issues.
Interest rate risk, right?
Mm-hmm.
They never really mature either. In a way, it kind of the portfolio is, being changed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a bond guy anyway, so.
That one's too easy, yeah. Okay. So I think what I'm hearing right now is go back to Wilmington Trust. Just find out, you know, it's exactly that. You know, they're just waiting to this thing. Find out more about that. And then potentially, you know, go from there and maybe look at some other things. Mm-hmm. But again, I still think the thing that you need to continue to look at is are there ways to try to enhance some returns without taking on a lot of additional risk to get there. You know, it's that balance. And I think your move from going from 8 to 7.5 was very helpful. When you were 8 and 60% equities, that was very widespread.
I don't think good corporate bonds are too risky. I mean, especially with one of the trusts is not going to be going out and buying, you know, we have to buy investment grade, but I mean, I know they'll be buying top quality. Corporates.
As long as they don't buy Wilmington Trust bonds, we're okay.
Yeah.
It is interesting that despite, and we all know the difficulties they went through, M&T chose to keep the Wilmington Trust name not just here, but actually all of my other clients in Pennsylvania that either use Wilmington Trust as a custodian when a couple of museums from the fixed income side also, they've chosen to keep the Wilmington Trust name because it had, you know, such a good reputation, you know, despite the obvious difficulties they ran into. So
they're big in Florida too. I mean,
yeah,
the Wilmington Trust, they got a pretty good business there.
Why don't I go on to OPEB, wrap that up? I'm sure you've probably seen enough of me as it is, but page 33. And then I do want to talk about the addendum for a moment when I'm done. And then we do have the updates. So OPEB, market value, over $30 million now. As I mentioned earlier, truly the best funded OPEB fund I've seen out there. And most of them still are not funded. And your point is exactly correct. A lot of governments can't even or can barely even make their pension payments. You know, they're saying, How can I deal with this? But they're going to have to eventually. Second quarter, $1 million gain, net $3.8 million for the year. County reimbursed at end of fiscal year. That was the cash flow I mentioned, and therefore there was some selling of some of the equity mutual funds also to get you back to the 60-40 split, because with those cashing out, you would have been much higher in equities than your targets. You can see the quarterly returns, the 1-year returns. Investment policy statement, cash target. Currently, your investment policy statement does not have a target for cash, because our understanding at the time, and I think it was that we thought, okay, so the county's making the payments. This is when we wrote it back in 2010. So therefore, we don't need to break cash in there. But the reality is over the last 3 years, there's been a lot of cash in there. And actually, that has drugged down return relative to your policy index. Okay. The equity target, that's just an issue of, you know, do you stay at 60%, okay? And the international equity target, of your 60%, you are 12% is your target for international, okay? I will tell you that and it doesn't mean that you follow what our others do. I'm just giving this a point of reference. Our other clients who are 60% equities had a 14% target, and we've recently moved them or are in the process of recommending to them have a target of 16. So one of the things you might want to consider, and actually you are actually having your assets managed, we're managing them at a 14% target because we had talked about that, but you never formalized that in your investment policy statement, was I'd like to see you increase that international target at least to 14, if not 16. You know, and actually what we would do from an implementation perspective, keep in mind we've got one more quarter that you're trying this out, but whether you do it this or through, go back to the advisory, straight advisory, whatever, is get a little bit more allocation to the global equity side. We like global equities, which buy U.S. and non-U.S. stocks, okay? Right now you have Thornburg as your global equity manager. there's another one that we would add to the lineup, because we have seen, both for yourselves and our other clients and our studies, that the area where you've been able to add the most alpha is the global area, above and beyond just straight domestic and straight international. They're really good managers who have the latitude to either over or underweight U.S. versus international, have added value that way. So even though if you went to 12 to from 12, say, to 14, or 16 if you were really brave, that we would put it with the global managers, and so therefore if the global managers don't like international as much, they might overweight the U.S. So you might not always be right at 14 or 16. You know, and I say that because sometimes people say, oh, geez, isn't that being more aggressive? No, not necessarily. And actually, probably could stand to be just a little bit more aggressive anyway. There are some changes that we're going to probably implement late September. Not a whole lot, because the portfolio, as you can see, has done a whole lot better than it had been doing. But there's a couple other changes. And glad to share with you some who those mutual funds are that we're thinking of. But so anyway, that's my point is I'd like you to strongly consider upping that international target. Otherwise, we're going to have to, although we had the latitude to recommend allocations that took you to 14 relative to your investment policy statement, we've never felt real comfortable being off of that target. And so we'd rather either move the target, or if not, then we're going to get a little bit out of the international side. So bring it down to 12. So
I think the 14's fine, but I guess to go right now, I guess I just am a little leery about on the global side, especially Europe with all the international problems going on and issues with Ukraine and Russia and so on. It just seems like when there's a lot of volatility there.
Well, that's why I like global better than straight international, because if a manager is an international manager, they've got to buy just international. They don't buy U.S. stocks. If they're global and they perceive that non-U.S. is more risky, then they will instead of being, say, 50, the benchmark is about 50-50 between U.S. and non-U.S. But if they're skitterish on non-U.S., they might go up to 60% U.S. They will actually tilt. So that's why I think global actually better accomplishes what you're suggesting, you know.
This is a dumb question. I'm awfully sorry. But I'm just wondering, as I look at page 36 and a lot of the conversation thus far, that I'm wondering why the investment policy for OPEB needs to be any different than the investment policy for the pension plan. And couldn't we simplify our lives a lot by having a single investment policy and a single investment approach and a single set of investment managers, as opposed to a right brain, left brain kind of thing, when our investment objectives, I think, and even the flows might be similar between the two plans?
I think it started because the OPEB was a startup and it was so tiny, we couldn't, you know, in order to move a little bit, you had to be kind of broad and think it was that your understanding, Dave? I mean, as far as the origin of it.
Well, I think it's even more the state. You could not invest the OPEB assets into the state pool. That there was a regulation or edict, or whatever, from the, I think it was the control of the currency that prohibited OPEB assets being part of that pool, okay? And so, therefore, you could not invest there. So that precluded that. Plus, even though the OPEB and the state has done quite well, and what we could do is we could go back to the state and say, hey, has that changed? I know there was some move afoot to change those regulations. I just don't know that they had, but there was at least concern in the past that you actually, as well as the state has done some areas, you had some difficulties at certain periods of time. From an administrative perspective, in one case, you guys were credited with an extra $1 million that wasn't yours, and they had to come back and take that $1 million back away from you. Now, it wasn't yours in the first place, but if you recall that. Yes. So there were a couple other things along the way that I thought, at least my impression was, yes, we'll live with that, and we'll live with having that, but if you look at the totality of the assets, how much of the totality of the assets do you want to have in an approach that at least generally would be more aggressive, maybe considerably more aggressive than really what I, at least I feel, is the, sort of the mentality of Sussex County. But I could surely, you know, ask the state, as I say, I know you're precluded from doing that. In fact, the only thing you could go through the state at that time, we should go through, they had a deal with Vanguard, and you would go double.
Yeah, they were investing in mutual funds. I mean, they had practically no state money in the fund, or there was a little bit. And we were just starting our OPEB fund. So we went through them kind of thinking they would have a similar, they'd have a similar actively managed type fund. And it turned out we were paying the state a fee, and they were just investing in a variety of like Vanguard ETFs and stuff. And then we thought, well, why we can do this? Why are we paying them this fee? Yeah.
You were paying the state to go invest in some Vanguard index funds.
So
true.
Then we got out.
I think Mrs. Deaver didn't want to replicate the investments that we had in our pension fund either. When it was a meeting when she was on the committee, you know, she didn't want to. She said, "Let's not duplicate what we got." Which, you know, then, as Mike points out, at the state, but, you know, kind of wanted to go with different investments to spread the risk, and et cetera, you know. You know, we had some good ones in the pension.
That's right.
You know, will we be considering the increase in global next meeting or future meeting or the percentage increase?
We have the OPEB. Do you have a sheet on that or talking about OPEB allocations and changing that?
Yeah,
we can do that.
I think in there, yeah, the staple page. So,
what I do with that?
We threw everything in, including the kitchen sink and that sink in this, and then you can pull out what you don't want. But one was decreasing the fixed income target from 40 to 39 and increasing the cash target from 0 to 1, just to reflect that you're always going to have some cash in there, okay? So the total, the increase in the international target from 12 to 14.
Sweet.
And commensurately, decrease in domestic equity from 48 to 46. Still a total of 60% in equities.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were also going to recommend changing the benchmark from international from the IFA to the MSCI ACWI index, ACWI XUS. Sounds like a small nuanced difference, but the IFA index does not include emerging markets. The ACWI XUS does include emerging markets, and emerging markets actually are about 23% of the overall international market. So we think it's a better reflection of what should be the right benchmark, you know, because the reality is, most of these funds are going to invest, you know, 15, 20, 25% in emerging markets.
I don't know if you're seeking a motion, but if you are, I would certainly move this addendum as outlined here be adopted as into our OPEB investment policy statement.
Okay. Yes, I have a motion to make these recommendations to council to change our investment policy statement.
Second.
I have a second from Mr. Baker. I'll take the vote. Mr. James?
Yes.
Mr. Baker?
Yes.
Mr. Leahy?
Yes.
And Ms. Ryan?
Yes.
And I vote yes. Motion carried. Thank you. That helps keep this in line from what we're running anyway. It's definitely a good thing. All right. Is there any more questions for Mr. Schoen this time?
I promise to ask that question no more than once a year as to why we have two different investment lawyers.
It's a good question.
It is a good question.
No.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard it before, so it was helpful for me.
You could say this is government or something, you know.
Well, it's, I think it's more my memory, but thank you for the education as well. Very, very well put together.
And next item is additional business. I just want to make you aware that the state of Delaware has passed regulation that our pension, our paramedics can join their pension if they so choose to do. So there's analysis being done right now by the state how much it would cost us to buy in years of service for them. And then we'll have our actuary look at it and see how this affects us if the paramedics were to choose to go with the state. So, and they would have to go as a group. It's ultimately the county's choice. But just want to let you be aware that that's out there and it's being looked into at this time.
So that would remove folks from our plan?
That's correct. About 100.
We have 20-year pension. 20-year vested for, I'm trying to remember, for paramedics? Or
25.
It's 25. What is the state?
Theirs is 20. But and their contribution, they have to contribute 7% versus right now we have the 3% for new employees. So even though it's 20 years, there's also other side to it.
So individually they could each make that decision?
It's all or none.
Oh, it's all or none.
Yes. So we're going to have the work done and analyze it and what's best for the group as a whole, whether they would all go or stay here.
Would we have to make a capital contribution to the state?
If we buy in years and we're getting an analysis done, I think it's 5, 10, or all years being bought in.
Yeah.
But how much that would cost us.
Mm-hmm.
That now.
Are you required to do that? I mean, are you required, like if someone has 10 years of experience and they go to the state fund, do you buy in that?
That would be our choice, how much we want to buy in. And everybody would be 10 years, well, if they at least had 10 years here,
right.
They would all get that, all get 5 years or no years. We don't have to buy in any years. And then from this point forward, they now contribute to the state pension plan.
So in essence, they would have two pensions. They would have this pension from what they've earned accrued
at this
so
point,
far, and then from whatever they earned from
yes.
the state.
I see.
And it is just the pension. It's not the OPEB. But, they would still be on our OPEB plan.
So our pension would stop, so to speak, for them, and then they would get 10 years, whatever experience they had with at this point, they would get a pension from the county based on that,
yes.
their service, even if it was.
Yes.
And the state would start up. Okay.
That's correct. Before we adjourn, Mr. Lawson just want to let you know to apologize. He had to leave. Senator Carper was visiting the airport and he had to go welcome him. Can I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
I have a motion and a second.
Second.
I have a second from Ms. Leahy. Or, sorry, Ms. Ryan. And I would take a vote. Mr. James?
Yes.
Mr. Baker?
Yes.
Mr. Leahy?
Yes.
And Ms. Ryan?
Yes.
I vote yes. And we are now adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.